Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess and a friend of Jurinov. And welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you want to download it and put it on your iPod, iPad, device, computer, and then hit play. Today we have a real interesting show, which I'm thrilled to be doing, and frankly, one of my favorite professors back when I went to Dwight Englewood High School in Englewood, New Jersey, Mrs. Taze. She would be thrilled to hear me doing this show, because today we're delving into the world of statistics and how it impacts electronic discovery. And I have to personally let everyone know I've had a love-hate relationship with the course of statistics. And it's, you know, I have my own little sampling of grades because I've taken it a number of times. I was an A student with Mrs. Taze because she was just fantastic. Then at UMass at an 8 a.m. startup four times a week, I turned into a C student, though I must say I was an A student for the first exam and then I stopped coming to class. That was sophomore year. A lot of stories about sophomore year, but I won't go into that one. Then at Carnegie Mellon, you know, as an MBA student, I gravitated towards any class which didn't involve engineering-level calculus, so I was an A student again. So my takeaway on statistics is how you deal with it can often be a product of your circumstances. Mrs. Taze is a great teacher, so I did well with her despite it being senior year. UMass was full of distraction sophomore year, so 8 a.m. was a little bit of a mistake to be taking this class, but at CMU I gave it the effort it deserves and did well again. So I'm sharing this story because many lawyers hate math, and that's why they become lawyers. But whether it comes naturally to use statistics in the world of electronic discovery is a building block. And if you're serious about this space, you should invest the time to learning about recall, precision, and how to get comfortable with review results. It's the core of making a defensibility argument. So enough of my preaching. I've got some excellent guests on the show today who have been A students their whole lives in the field. First guest has been on the show a number of times, Herb Roiplatt. He's one of the pioneers in search and retrieval and the chief scientist at Orchitech. Prior to this, he was the chief scientist and co-founder of Dolphin Search, as well as an award-winning professor of psychology at the University of Hawaii. He has been awarded one patent and has two patents pending on conceptual searching technology. Herb is well recognized as an expert in search and retrieval technology, particularly in the area of e-discovery. In addition to his scientific work, Herb has been writing extensively about the problems of dealing with massive amounts of electronic data and the emerging standards of dealing with those problems. He's a member of Sedona Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production, on the advisory board of the Georgetown Legal Center Advanced E-Discovery Institute, a member of the 2011 Program Committee for the Georgetown Legal Center Advanced E-Discovery Institute, and chair of the Electronic Discovery Institute. He's a member of the Board of Governors of the Organization of Legal Professionals, and Herb is a frequent speaker on e-discovery, particularly concerning search, categorization, predictive coding, and quality assurance. Dave Lewis is a consulting computer scientist. He wears many hats. He's a leading academic researcher in information retrieval and text mining, a software designer and inventor with 8 patents, and an expert witness in patent and e-discovery cases. He was a co-founder of the TREC Legal Track Evaluation of Information Retrieval Technology for e-discovery and built the first public test collection for e-discovery research. In recognition of all that, he was elected a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 2006. I met him last year when he moderated a session on machine-assisted review at a meeting of the Association for Litigation Support Professionals in Chicago. We became friends, and our paths crossed again when he was on the organizing committee for the DESI-4 conference in Pittsburgh earlier this year. Thanks, Dave and Herb, for joining us here on the show. And, hey, I'd like to first start off. You both came to the DESI-4 conference pre-picnic party at my house wearing bush hats, and you were the two statisticians there that I knew. Is there any reason for that? You know, is this something
just
that we can find statistically?
No, it's off my
yeah,
head.
Statistics on melanoma.
Okay. I always like to start my programs by asking how you got interested in electronic discovery. So, first of all, Dave, why don't you start off?
I was working with some folks at IIT, Ofer Frieder and Dave Grossman and others,
Illinois Institute of Technology on building a test collection for one of the intelligence agencies for studying retrieval of scanned documents. And I was looking around for a big set of scanned documents. This is 6-7 years ago. And I found the documents that had come out in the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement. So this is 7 million documents, 40 million pages of the internal files of the big tobacco companies. And I said, wow, this is a really cool data set. And then that brought me into organizing the first legal track with Jason Barron and Doug Ord, and I've been interested ever since.
Great. And Herb, yourself?
Well, I got in kind of by accident. We had founded Dolphin Search, and we're trying to do some other kinds of work and trying to sell knowledge management, and people said, one of these days we're going to get to it. And then we came across eDiscovery, and we said, people will pay us money to make TIFFs for them, free money. And we had no idea how hard it was at the time. So we set up all the computers in the office and started making TIFFs, and then we started discovering why they were willing to pay money for us to make TIFFs, because it wasn't so easy. Then we got more and more into eDiscovery, and that we kind of got dragged in. But once we started getting dragged in, I got very enthusiastic about it.
And Herb, we use statistics all the time in law without even thinking about it. In torts, we often look to a standard of care of what a reasonable person would agree is reasonable conduct. So first of all, what's the statistical principle in that statement? And as a follow-up, what do you see is important about statistics?
Well, there are two kinds of statistics that we need to talk about. There's the baseball kind of statistics, where people just keep counts of various things and can talk about, you know, what your batting average is. And then there are inferential statistics, where you try to use the evidence from one set of observations to make inferences about another set of observations. The baseball statistics people find more intuitively obvious. They have an easy time understanding what a batting average is. But if you want to talk about the kind of inferential statistics, like reasonableness, you have to understand how a particular example of something, like standard of care, how a particular example of something fits into the average. How does it relate to the average, like the batting average? Is this batter better than other batters? Then you start making inferences about your observations. People do this intuitively all the time. There's a lot of research, actually, on how people make intuitive statistical inferences. I think that what scares people about statistics is the fact that it's taught kind of from a cookbook perspective, so they don't get to see how really it's related to real-life events, where the statistical inferences come from, and why they're reasonable. In the context.
Okay. Dave, what are the two or three statistical concepts that attorneys should understand as most important for applying statistics in electronic discovery?
Well, I guess following from what Herb said, when we're doing e-discovery, we're interested in the effectiveness of some sort of review process. How well are we deciding which documents to turn over to the other side? How well are we deciding whether something's privileged or not? And that how well gets summed up with, I guess, the first concept, which I guess is more of a machine learning or information retrieval one, is that of an effectiveness measure, some way of quantifying how well we did. From the standpoint of statistics, an effectiveness measure would be a statistics, a quantity that's defined on some population. And then the two important notions are, one, estimation, and this gets to what Herb was talking about with inferential statistics. We have some things we know, and we want to infer something about this thing we can't measure directly, for instance, because it's on a very large population of documents, and we want to avoid looking at everything. So we're trying to look at something in order to estimate something else. And then the thing that we typically look at is a sample. So that would be the second important notion, the notion of sampling or a sample, where we've drawn some of the items from a large population, and we're going to look at those items carefully, and we're going to draw them carefully in a way that lets us infer something about the value of statistic on the large population. So I would say estimation and sampling are the most important notions from statistics. And then there's the buzzword of an effectiveness measure, which comes from machine learning or information retrieval.
Herb, yeah. In particular,
well,
okay, go ahead, Herb.
Something I want to say about statistics, to follow on what Dave was saying, is just a way of making a principled argument. There's nothing magic about the statistics. There's nothing special about it in any deep way. It's that scientists and statisticians for many years have been exploring how exactly you go about understanding the different ways that events can happen, counting and inferring. And from their experiences, from their analysis of it, they've come up with a formula or two that is taught as a cookbook for most people who take statistics. And that formula tells you how things, how you're licensed, to use a statistical term, to talk about certain things based on other observations that you've made. There's nothing in the kind of argument that you make in statistics that is different from the kind of argument you make from any kind of evidence. You know that based on this kind of evidence, you can say these kinds of things, and that's the essence of statistical inference.
So, Herb, in particular, why is sampling so important in electronic discovery? You know, and what are some of the common misperceptions that you're hearing from lawyers about sampling?
Sampling is critical for what Dave said. That is, you get to look at a relatively small number of items, usually documents in our case, and from your observations of that small number of items, you're, again, licensed in the statistical sense to make inferences about the whole population. In order to do that, you have to have a representative sample. And the easiest way to get a representative sample is to get a truly random sample. In a truly random sample, every document has an equal chance of being a member of your sample. Every document in your population has an equal chance of being a member of the sample. When that happens, then you can make your best inferences about how your sample is going to be representative of the whole population. We see exactly the same kind of thing when we do election polling. If you want to do a poll about who's going to vote for or against a certain candidate, you have to sample a certain number of people. And the greater the number of people you sample, the more accurate your poll is going to be. And if you sample like 400 people, then your poll is going to be accurate plus and minus 5%. And we'll get back to that later. But the sample, if it's truly random, is going to be representative of the population as a whole, and you can then draw inferences about the population.
So David,
sometimes,
okay, go ahead.
Sometimes lawyers come to me and they say, well, you know, we can't possibly do sampling because some documents are more responsive than others, or because this custodian has more responsive documents than that custodian, and sampling is going to be somehow inappropriate for that. And that's wrong.
Yeah, actually, a good example of that was the Zubilee case when they went and sampled backup tapes, and it's not that they found anything particularly really damaging in the documents that turned up on the tapes. It was just that they hadn't been produced and they were relevant. There was an inference there was more out there in the other backup tapes that hadn't been produced. So
Exactly. And in the Zubilee case, the Zubilee got the benefit of the doubt in this sense. She got to pick which tapes to sample, so they weren't truly random. They were more in her favor than a truly random one would be. But still, I think it was appropriate in that particular case. Judge Shindlin's choice of sampling, I think, was useful for what needed to be established in that situation.
Okay. It's interesting hearing the lawyer got the benefit of the doubt. I've never heard her present it that way. But anyway, let's go to the next question. So David, how can attorneys get comfortable creating samples to validate the results when in many cases they don't have math backgrounds? Isn't it just easier to look at everything?
Well, it's worth keeping in mind that the potential benefits from sampling can be gigantic. If we're potentially talking about, if maybe you've done a good review and you've looked at 100,000 documents, you've used predictive coding or something, and you can demonstrate that, with sampling, looking at, a few thousand random ones or in some cases even a few hundred, that you've found almost all the responsive material, you might, be able to save yourself looking at millions of documents. So the benefits are potentially immense. On the difficulty side, I think it's important to recognize that the sampling itself, the random selections, the computation of confidence intervals and confidence levels, all these things can be automated in the software. So it's not like you're going to be back in math class, working this out by pencil and paper. I think the basic notions, as Herb and I have been saying, are not that difficult. And I think more to the point, it may be sort of tricky the first few times that people are making these sort of arguments, but as in any part of the law, they'll evolve kind of a standard language and standard arguments to make. And then finally, judges are starting to insist on it, so there's not really any choice.
Okay. Herb, here's the difficult question. I think we decided for this is where we're going to lose most of the lawyers. What are confidence levels and confidence intervals, and how do they play into electronic discovery?
Confidence levels are very simply, how confident are you? Are you really, really confident, or are you kind of confident? And actually, that notion is pretty easy to get across. People have some intuitive idea of that. In science, for example, it's standard to use a 95% confidence level. And what that means is that if you repeated this experiment 100 times, 95 times out of 100, your results would be similar to what you actually observed. Then we get to the notion of what does similar mean. That's where the confidence interval comes in. The confidence interval is a measure of how much similarity is reasonable, if you will. It tells you, again, remember when we talked about polling, you talked about plus and minus 5%. That's related to the confidence interval. So you're going to say that based on this sample, the population has will vote in this particular way, plus and minus 5% of the vote. That's a confidence interval. The confidence interval and the confidence level together tell you how big your sample needs to be in order for it to achieve that level of confidence and that range of confidence, if you will, that range of results, if you will. The narrower the confidence interval, so if you want to say plus and minus 1% rather than plus and minus 5%, your sample size has to be bigger. If you want 99% confidence rather than 95% confidence, your sample size has to be bigger. You combine those two things and you feed them into a fairly simple formula that you can actually compute in Excel, and that tells you how big your sample needs to be for various kinds of tests.
And we'll have a follow-up question on sample size in a minute. But, Herb, so when does an attorney use sampling in an individual in a case? I mean, how do you see it best being used?
Well, I see two places where it's frequently used, and I think quite reasonably. The first is let's try to get a notion of how rich this collection is. Are responsive documents really, really rare? Are responsive documents really common? So kind of part of the perhaps the early case assessment time when you go in and you say, okay, what are we dealing with and how common are responsive documents? Another way that I see sampling being used is really where we started this conversation in terms of measuring effectiveness. So you've gone and you've done a review. How confident are you in the quality of the review? How do you know that it's reasonable? Well, one measure of it being reasonable is to set up a confidence level, a confidence interval, if that's appropriate, and say, do we meet those standards? Someone else can always argue, well, you should have met higher standards, but now you're into the common kind of reasonableness argument that lawyers are comfortable making.
And David, let's talk a little bit about the structure of sampling. Individual documents or document families, how do these play together?
Well, it depends on how you're choosing to measure effectiveness. So say if we look at the situation of evaluating the effectiveness of a review, if, for instance, part of the agreement with the other side is that we're going to turn over an entire document family, that is, say, an email message and all of its attachments, if any one of those documents is responsive, then you probably want to think of the effectiveness of review as operating at the level of your families. So you would want to sample families. On the other hand, you may be making responsive assessments individually for each document. You're not necessarily turning over the entire family. Then you'd probably want to sample from the individual documents. So it depends. Everything follows from what your measure of quality, your measure of effectiveness is.
So, Dave, do you want to talk about when it makes a difference whether you measure by document or by family?
How do you get different results? Well, I think I would view that as following from what you've decided the right answers are. If responsiveness is kind of a contagion, that if it's in any member of the family, it's going to spread to the whole family, then it seems like that's the natural sampling unit, because otherwise you could fool yourself. You sample one document from a family, but it's going to depend on whether it's a family that's got 50 a message that's got 50 attachments or a message that's by itself. So yeah, I think I would simply say it depends on what you're assuming about the nature of responsiveness and how you're going to measure the quality of what you turn over.
So, David, one of the things we hear in presentations, frequently now, and people are beginning to talk more and more about predictive coding and validating your results is, the sample sizes oftentimes are much smaller than we intuitively think they should be. For example, I've heard someone present that all you need to look at is 381 documents randomly to give you a 95% confidence level. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this very much goes to what Herb was saying about, what confidence level do you want? What confidence interval width do you want? And then also, what is your measure of effectiveness? So, those numbers that you get here thrown around like 300-400, that I'm going to pull this out of thin air, but my guess would be that's a 95% confidence interval on a binomial proportion. But that's not necessarily. I mean, you, as Herb said, you might want 99%. You might want a 1% confidence width. You might want to be measuring F measure or recall precision, both recall and precision. So it's not quite as simplistic as saying you can always get away with sampling 300-400 documents. In particular, if you want to be making strong statements about the number of responsive documents that were missed in a review and get some sort of tight, get that down to within a few hundred plus or minus, you're going to be looking at a sample that's in the thousands to do that for typical collections. The thing I would say, and I think on the positive side here, the thing that's sort of wonderful about sampling is that once the collection gets over a fairly modest size, the size of the sample does not change as the collection increases. So if you've determined what's a reasonable sample for 50,000 documents, it's going to be basically the same size sample if it's 5 million instead of 50,000. So I think maybe that's the thing that, that people find sort of counterintuitive and wonderful about sampling.
I got to tell you, when I started learning statistics, the independence of the population size, I just said, that can't be right. It can't be right. And I banged at it and worked at it and chewed on it, and it's right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, so sometimes statistics is your friend in that way.
But sometimes lawyers like to be doing lots of work.
Yeah. Well, look, I did a paper in the Sedona Conference Journal in 2007 where I laid out a statistical test that one can do for quality. I called it illusion. And in there is a table that says how many documents you have to sample to achieve a given confidence level and a given, in this case, the statistic that we need to worry about is the, is the number, proportion of documents we're willing to leave behind. And depending on how conservative you want to be, the sample sizes can go from, you know, around 400 to around 40,000.
So, Herb, how does software for search and retrieval use statistics to improve search and retrieval?
Well, there are different kinds of measures. Dave's mentioned the precision. Precision is the purity of the result, and recall is the completeness of the result. So purity is of the documents that have been retrieved, how many of them actually are responsive, and recall is of the responsive documents in the collection, how many have actually been retrieved. So we use those kinds of statistics to measure our performance overall. And in order to do that, we usually have to sample because by the time we've read the entire collection, there's not much that that can be done. We're trying to save work. And, you know, the big problem probably the big problem in e-discovery is that the volume of documents has grown so much that even though unit prices per document have declined for processing, the cost of reading the documents is still outrageously high and can overwhelm the amount at risk in a particular case. So people are looking for ways of decreasing the volume of documents that they have to look at. You can use your statistics and your sampling to identify things you do have to look at, things you don't have to look at, and whether you've missed things in your collection, for example. So I worked on a case a while ago where they used keyword and custodian culling. By the time they were done, they had the documents reviewed. 6% of the documents that they selected with keyword and custodian culling ended up being responsive, and the rest being non-responsive. And they never measured the documents that they didn't select in their culling process, so they have no idea what they left behind, what they missed. We can use statistics then to evaluate and measure what we produce and what we don't produce, and be able to stand up and say, look, we did a reasonable job. Here's our evidence that we did a reasonable job.
David, you do some consulting in electronic discovery, and you know, maybe I'll also ask Herb if he has any thoughts on this, but have you ever heard of a case with sanctions when an attorney did sampling up front to validate their results? I'm not aware of one, but I figured, you know, I'd throw it out to both of you to see if you're aware of anything.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not the right person to ask. But no, I haven't heard that. I guess I did want to inject something into the previous question. So Herb talked about the use of the kind of inferential statistics, effectiveness measures in search and retrieval software. A topic for a whole another show would be that essentially all the software that's used, except for Boolean retrieval, you know, all the ranked retrieval software, all the predictive review software uses statistics in its algorithms to be able to find documents effectively. So I'll just sort of mention that's in there. That'd be a whole other topic. Herb, have you heard any cases like that?
I have not, and I've talked to lots of judges. My understanding of sanctions is they're almost always for lying.
Yeah, that's
not
my
for doing
sense
something.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah.
And many of the judges I talk to say the same thing. They can't, of course, say that about their own cases, but they say that about the other judges' cases.
That's why I said sampling up front, because there have been situations where people have tried to sample their way out of a problem, and that's a little different. Dave, one of the debates in electronic discovery today is, are human reviewers the gold standard compared to machine-assisted review? Do you have any thoughts about this debate from sort of a statistical perspective?
Sure. I mean, that's probably the biggest can of worms out there right now. Because one of the things that happened, of course, is people started using machine learning methods, started using more automated methods. There was always, well, we have to evaluate this, we have to sample, we have to compute effectiveness. That's fine. That's the tradition in machine learning and information retrieval. But then what we found out when we started doing all this sampling is that we found out that, you know, there was a significant, you know, the effectiveness of traditional human review, if you think of traditional human review as a classifier, we'll just say is far from perfect. So I think the field is coming to grips with the fact that human review was always making a lot of mistakes. And then you've got this real knotty question, well, if we're using human review as the gold standard to evaluate machine review, what do we do about the fact that there's some substantial error rate in the human review? This is one of the central questions that's been looked at in the legal track the past few years. There's starting to be quite a body of academic literature on this. People are coming up with, you know, various sort of multi-stage review processes to try to get at least a small sample of documents that we've got accurately measured well enough to be a gold standard for then testing other things against. So I would say this is an area where the research is moving very, very quickly right now, and new methods are likely to be emerging over the next few years.
And, you know, something that I thought was funny that ties into what you're saying, I've spent a lot of time over the last 2-3 years talking to lawyers and lit support professionals about advanced analytics. And typically, if you try hard within a firm, you'll find someone that completely buys into this, okay, at almost every firm. But it's a law of numbers to throw a statistical concept out here that, you know, trying to convince the others that this is defensible, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, one of the techniques that this really creative lit support manager I was talking to said that they were using was they said, well, let's forget about predictive coding. Why don't we just do some sampling of our human reviews and what we're leaving behind and things like that. And just, you know, just to validate what we're doing and try to first open up a can of worms that way.
And obviously this should have been done, you know, for the past 70 years. And, you know, it's just now starting to happen.
Yeah, the Greeks were the people that invented statistics were around a long time ago. Why weren't you guys yelling about this 70 years ago?
Well, let's go back to your notion of standard of care. And, you know, what would an ordinary attorney do?
There you go.
And so that's why it didn't have to be measured.
Who left math behind a long time ago.
Yeah.
No, it's...
Math doesn't need to be so scary. Math itself has an intimidation factor that I don't quite understand. It's a language for talking about things. It's a way of making the kinds of arguments that attorneys make. Attorneys will often delve into deep technical things in order to make an IP, intellectual property case or an accident investigation. They will become experts at amazingly complex technology. But when it comes time to mastering their own statistics, to master their own processes, they just kind of freeze up very often. At one level, I don't understand that.
I can understand it completely. I did a dual degree with my MBA at Carnegie Mellon, which was engineering-level calculus, math-intensive, and I did a dual degree at law school at Pitt Law. And I can tell you the types of people in these two programs were incredibly different. These were radically different populations of people and how they approach things. So
I understand that, but still, lawyers, you know, if they're working on a plane crash, they'll master whatever level of technology technical expertise they need to be able to talk about that plane crash. But when it comes time to dealing with their own stuff, they don't seem interested or capable. It's probably interested more than capable of evaluating their own processes with the same kind of view.
Probably has something to do with in a plane crash, you're immersing yourself into a specific set of facts and documents. But when you're talking about general statistics, it's just, you know, it's.
That may be the
general
answer.
Discussion.
Yeah,
that may be
the
answer.
Yeah, I think Herb's right. It's not that, you know, the legal profession is unable to take this stuff on. As Herb points out, in the context of particular cases, I've worked on a lot of patent cases. You know, lawyers in the context of particular cases will get in and master incredibly technical information. I mean, lawyers, you know, in some sense are trained to be generalists in that fashion. And I think it really just has to do more with the traditions and expectations, and that, you know, as, you know, it'll come down to if judges start asking for this, you know, everyone's going to master this stuff.
Yep. No, I agree, and they will. I have no doubt about it. It's one reason we're doing this show. So, well, Herb, another question that sort of follows up the question I just asked Dave before we got distracted on my rant, but is – what about finding the smoking gun document? You know, because that's the thing that keeps lawyers up at night when we're talking about sampling and using machines to do the review.
Yeah, there are two answers to that. The first answer is smoking guns typically have friends. So there's rarely only one instance of a smoking gun. The second answer to that is if it's true, which it is, that people are relatively poor at identifying responsive documents, what makes you think that employing a team of 100 reviewers is going to come up with that smoking gun any more than anything else will?
I guess the third thing that I'll mention is often the smoking gun is – you may have some sense of what the smoking gun would be like if it existed. And I think one of the ways that people get at that is to not just do review for responsive, non-responsive, privilege, non-privilege, but to look for particular categories of documents. And that, so even if the smoking gun was itself rare, you might be able to say something about, well, let's look for documents about, you know, product X, or let's look for documents that mention issues of liability. And if you're coding for some of these individual concepts, then you can sort of, build relatively accurate classifiers for that. Here I'm slipping into talking about machine learning again. And then you can begin looking at, like, looking for combinations of concepts and things like that. So I think in some cases, there's the ability to sort of zoom in and see whether there might be something that has particular dangerous properties.
Yeah, it's like the old Reese's peanut butter commercials. You know, the humans and the machines together make a good candy bar. I mean, the machines, a smart reviewer using machines can go search for where they think something is a lot more effectively than looking at a mass of documents. You really need both.
Well, Carl, that brings up another point that I see a trend emerging, and I know you and I have talked about this
a lot.
And that is to have, instead of hiring these actors who went to law school and don't really want to be lawyers, which is what we get in L.A., I see a real need for hiring professional reviewers who really know about document review, who really know about the issues in the case, who are really well-trained. And I see the trend moving in that direction as we get more and more of the machine learning kinds of stuff going on, I think that there's going to be a trend towards more professionalism in document review.
Can I use that for commercial for Review Less? I feel like I'm in an ethical situation here. That was actually a really nice point. But I'm going to pass on talking more about it. This is about statistics, not about what I think.
But I'll follow up on that in the sense that I very much agree with Herb that there's sometimes and I think some of the coverage in the media, like the New York Times article and whatnot, is talking about machines, replacing armies of lawyers and whatnot. And I think the better way to look at it is these things like machine learning and advanced statistical methods and whatnot, they're power tools which enhance the capabilities of people. And if the people are better, then you get this sort of double enhancement. If you have good people with good tools, that's going to be the best outcome, and I think that's likely, I would agree with Herb, that I think that's likely the way that things will go. Because there is a bit of the sort of, hearkening back to the gold standard question, there is a bit of a kind of garbage in, garbage out problem here, that if you have really bad manual review, then you start training machines to imitate really bad manual review, you're not necessarily going to do very well. So I think there's sort of a virtuous cycle here, whereas if you have really good people and really good technology, that's where you're going to get the best result.
Well, I think we've pretty much beaten this topic to death here. This has been really a neat show. I appreciate you both taking the time to talk about this topic. So Herb and Dave, thanks for joining us here at ESI Bytes.
My pleasure.
Thanks
so much. I mean, it's been a great conversation talking with both of you.
Great. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do more shows with you later this year. I always love it, David, when guests throw out a future show idea. I'll write that one down and we'll talk. But
okay.
I'd like to also thank our sponsor, Jurinov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our shows. You can also remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out, as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of Review Less, wishing you a nice day.